From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Flint reluctantly stays with the Karenandi Water Authority, but more challenges lie ahead.
They have to build a pipeline from the city to the KWA pipeline. That's about $7 million. And there's also the question of where's the city's secondary water source going to be?
Enbridge buying new technology for Line 5 under the Straits of Mackinac.
We're looking to make sure that we're able to contain and recover a potential, or if something was to occur, in open water, so to sort of prevent it actually ever making landfall.
Plus, longtime school board presidents who are stepping down offer their take on education in Michigan.
You've got people who are not educators legislating how to run a business that they don't know anything about.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. More and more members of elected school boards in Michigan are saying enough. They're walking away, burned out by the ongoing struggle with Lansing.
You're seeing the attempt to implement a business model on a school system. Round peg in a square hole is the first analogy that comes to mind. It just doesn't work.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, what's really behind the shortage of school board candidates? But first, Line 5, of course, is the name for the twin pipelines that have carried oil and gas from Superior, Wisconsin to Sarnia, Ontario. And that means the 63-year-old pipelines are running through the Straits of Mackinac. Environmental groups are calling for Line 5 to be shut down. They fear the catastrophic effects of an oil spill on the Great Lakes. Congress has just approved a pipeline safety bill that would toughen pipeline standards in and around the Great Lakes. The owner and operator of Line 5 is the Canadian energy company Enbridge. Enbridge said Line 5 has never leaked and it is safe. This week, the company is hosting community meetings throughout the Upper Peninsula to talk about an investment they're making for the safety of the Straits. Stephen Lloyd is the Senior Manager of Emergency Response for Enbridge. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
What's the purpose of the meetings this week?
Well, to really talk about some of the evolution around emergency management specifically at the Straits and some of the enhancements we're making in the area.
Give us an idea of what Enbridge is going to be doing to protect the Straits.
It's an evolution and of continuous improvements. Even going back as far as 2012, when we wrote a dedicated plan, we really want to take a hard look at the Straits, take a look at technologies that are out there that could help us in the unlikely event of a release and make sure we apply it. We're making a commitment to purchase approximately $7 million worth of new technology for the Straits of Mackinac and the area to help with rapid recovery if something was to occur.
What does this technology look like?
High-speed skimming technologies. You know, Straits of Mackinac is a very special place. The environmental conditions there, the weather conditions can change quickly. There's some days it can be quite pristine and flat water. The next day or the next hour could be wavy. And then, of course, during certain times of year, there's ice cover. So all those are special conditions for emergency response, and we want to make sure that we're doing all we can to address the concerns at those different times of year.
So high-speed skimmers, what other kinds of technology?
Skimming technology that you can actually utilize during ice pack or floating ice. The skimming and booming type technology we're purchasing also helps us during sort of choppier, wavier conditions. We're looking to make sure that we're able to contain and recover a potential, or if something was to occur, in open water to sort of prevent it actually ever making landfall.
Because I know that there are critics who really worry about emergency response plans being adequate for the kind of weather you get at the Straits, especially those days when waves can be 3 to 5 feet high. And both the U.S. Coast Guard and Marine Pollution Control have said if the waves are that high, which they can be for up to, 24 days of the year, they're concerned that would effectively keep the cleanup crews from going out on the water. Would this technology handle that kind of condition?
Marine Pollution Control and U.S. Coast Guard are quite right. When you get into unsafe conditions on the water, the number one concern for any kind of response is the safety of people and safety of responders. We wouldn't put people in harm's way. So even if the technology has the capability of doing certain things under certain specifications and certain conditions, if it's not safe for people, then we don't want to put people in harm's way.
I'm talking with Steve Lloyd, who's Senior Manager of Emergency Response for Enbridge, as we talk about new steps, including $7 million worth of new technology being announced this week by Enbridge. Steve, the political calculus seems to be shifting. As we mentioned, Congress just approved the tougher pipeline safety bill. You've got the likes of Michigan lawmakers like Representative Candace Miller and Senator Gary Peters and others behind the push. In fact, Representative Miller has introduced a bill that would actually shut down Line 5 if a study shows it's a significant risk to Great Lakes water. That's in committee now. Is this week's push in response to some of that?
I really don't know where the push for that is coming from. We're focused on, with my group, to make sure that we're prepared in the unlikely event of a release.
Especially in Michigan, so much of the concern about Line 5 goes back to the rupture of Line 6B and the historic spill into the Kalamazoo River. People remember what 843,000 gallons of oil did to the river and the surrounding area.
Yeah.
What do you think Enbridge learned from that event?
It was impactful to our organization and regrettable. It actually changed the way we did a lot of our business, the way we did emergency response. Since that time, a lot has changed. Not only the growth of my team in emergency management, but the way we write our plans, the way we demonstrate how we're prepared, staging of resources. And it was a very dark day for Enbridge.
What do you personally want to say on behalf of Enbridge to reassure people?
I think the important thing is to continue the conversation, just like we're doing here today, is sharing what we're doing, sharing how we're improving, sharing that evolution, and making sure people understand what we do.
What would be the life expectancy of any pipeline? And, you know, we're talking about Line 5 right now, so it's 63 years old. I know that vintage. It went down the year I was born. You kind of think about looking ahead. What kind of life expectancy does the company have for these pipelines, and what's being done to look beyond when they have reached their sell-by date?
Well, you know, with proper maintenance programs and rigorous monitoring, that the life expectancy can be indefinite. And I think a lot of those studies are being done, and a lot of that information is available.
Steve Lloyd, the Senior Manager of Emergency Response for Enbridge. Steve, thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside today.
Thanks for the opportunity.
We turn now to Michigan Radio's Mark Brush, who has been covering Enbridge and Line 5 for, lo, these many years now. Mark, $7 million worth of new technology, a week of community meetings. Is it enough to ease people's concerns?
Well, I think the short answer to that is no. I mean, I don't think, no matter what, nobody's going to be comfortable with a pipeline under Lake Michigan oil pipeline running through. The people I talk to, that's what I hear, is that they just can't get beyond the fact that there's an oil pipeline under the lakes there.
Even though it is 63 years old, and Steve Lloyd of Enbridge said to me, with the proper maintenance, the pipeline could be there and working indefinitely. And he says they're exceeding the government standards for safety.
Yeah, he's right about that. They are exceeding the government standards for safety. You can look at that in two ways. If you're Enbridge, you're exceeding the standards. But if you're on the outside, you're thinking, this is an indication that the standards are not tough enough on a company like Enbridge. A lot of people, you hear this news and you think they're buying this open water skimming equipment. They told me this is shifting their focus from letting the oil come up on the shoreline to going out in the water and getting it. Well, this pipeline's been there for 63 years. Why haven't they thought about an open water response before this? They'll tell you, you know, this is just, they're just improving the way they go about response. But the NWF has sued the federal government saying, their standards just aren't tough enough. They're not requiring companies like this to develop an open water plan.
Now, it does seem like we have to view these moves by Enbridge within the context of this changing political landscape in Michigan when it comes to pipelines, particularly Line 5. How have you seen the political calculus change for Enbridge over the last few years?
Steadily getting, you know, tighter and tighter on the company. I mean, this is a pipeline that was just unknown, you know, 5-6 years ago. Nobody knew about it. You know, after the spill in Kalamazoo,
Line 6B.
Then we started learning about Line 5 after that. We started looking at the pipelines that Enbridge owns. People were shocked to find out there's something under Lake Michigan. And since then, it's just been steadily increasing. In the last few months, it's been really ratcheting up, with Congress passing a law unanimously in the Senate, which
when
you never
do
you hear
see
of.
That?
Yeah, exactly. That will put more restrictions specifically on the pipeline in the Straits. One of the things the bill calls for, it's going to be signed by the president soon, will mean that Enbridge has to do yearly inspections internally on that pipeline. Before that, it was only every 5 years. So the pressure has been increasing on this company.
And we know Representative Miller has introduced a bill saying if the inspections don't work, you got to shut it down.
Right, yeah.
That was not part of this bill, but
that's Attorney General Bill Schuette, who's going to be probably running for governor, is saying the days of this pipeline are numbered.
And you've got the race for the 1st Congressional District. You've got Democratic candidate Lon Johnson right there on his website. Click on here to get communities all over the state to pass resolutions to shut down Line 5.
Yeah, Enbridge is feeling the pressure.
Coming up, as you mentioned, the Line 6B spill, we're coming up on the 6th anniversary of that, largest inland oil spill in U.S. history. And after what happened in Kalamazoo, can Enbridge really ever do enough to rebuild people's trust?
Yeah, I mean, I've been to that site of that spill, and you get a mixed response in the community there. You know, people obviously very upset about that spill, but the company did stay and spent a lot of money restoring that area, $1 billion. So they've worked hard at trying to rebuild that trust. They haven't left. Can they ever overcome, you know, an oil pipeline under Lake Michigan? That's a really heavy lift for them.
When you think of these community meetings this week and this $7 million investment in new technology, are you hearing from people, does this feel like a substantive effort or does it feel like window dressing?
The people that I talk to feel like this is window dressing. This is something that you know, it's unpredictable what will happen out in the Straits if there's an oil spill. Having this equipment on the shorelines just out there, you know, doesn't necessarily allay their fears. I mean, Enbridge is making a definite effort. This pipeline makes money for them. They want to keep it there. And so they are doing a full court press trying to engage the community as best as they can.
And as Mr. Lloyd told me, with proper maintenance, Line 5 could operate indefinitely. But are you hearing any kind of rumblings that Line 5 could be on the table to be shut down?
Well, you know, one thing you can tell about the political landscape changing, you see yard signs now, shut down Line 5. But I don't hear, you know, there's lawsuits happening. They are kind of tightening the standards around this particular pipeline. But I don't hear specifically, we're going to shut it down, you know, imminently. If the company were to need to do maintenance or replace the pipeline the way they did 6B, it probably would just not happen in Michigan. Michigan wouldn't give them the permits to put a new pipeline in there. So, you know, they kind of got to say this pipeline is an indefinite thing.
Michigan Radio's Mark Brush. Thanks so much, Mark.
You're welcome.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's official. The city of Flint will stay with the new KWA pipeline for its future source of drinking water. Michigan Radio Steve Carmody was at today's announcement from Governor Snyder and Flint Mayor Karen Weaver. Steve, ever since she was elected last November, Mayor Weaver's been taking a really hard look at Flint's participation in KWA, hasn't she?
Yes, she has. She's been looking for a way of getting the city out of this contract. This was originally negotiated and agreed to by the emergency managers who ran Flint for 4 years. And at the time that this was put into place, the mayor and the city council really had no power. And since they've regained their power, one of the things they've wanted to do is get out of this this pipeline contract. And this is about bringing fresh water to the city.
What was the tone of today's announcement that, yes, we're staying with KWA? What was Mayor Weaver's tone?
I would say the mayor announced that the city was going to go to KWA very reluctantly, and she sounded very resigned to a decision that she herself just did not sound like she was that thrilled about. And this is what the mayor had to say about it at her news conference today.
This is where we are, and we've got to make the best of a situation, whether we agree with the situation that we're in or not. And so now it's time for us to do some things to move forward.
So what do we think has been going on here behind the scenes, Steve?
Well, the mayor obviously has been trying to get the state and the county to give the city a bit of a break because this is a little bit expensive for the city. The original idea was going with KWA would be less expensive than getting water from Detroit. And in the long term, the water will be, but in the short term, the city has several major expenses they have to take into account. Number one, they have to build a pipeline from the city to the KWA pipeline. That's about $7 million. And there's also the question of where's the city's secondary water source going to be, whether the city is going to be tapping or continue to get water as a secondary source from Detroit, or whether the city builds a very expensive reservoir that they can use. At this point, there is absolutely no plans for them to use the Flint River as a backup. Now, the state and the county did budge a little bit to help the city with the pipeline question. Again, I said it was going to be about $7 million to build that connecting pipeline. The county says they'll help a little bit with the engineering on that, and the state is offering about $4 million to help towards the cost of building that new pipeline. But that means the city still has some expensive things they have to do. And in the long term, they also have to upgrade the city's water plant, which had all the problems leading up to the city's water crisis.
Because Detroit provides treated water, right? But the KWA water is going to be raw, so it would need to be treated.
Exactly. And now the difference between treating river water and treating lake water is pretty significant. It's I don't want to say it's easier treating lake water, but the city doesn't, well, probably avoid the problems they've had in the past with treating the Flint River water. But still, the EPA has said the Flint water plant isn't ready to treat the lake water yet. So there's a lot that the city has to do, and it's very expensive, and the city is still pushing for more help to deal with this problem.
So it certainly sounds like it was just maybe too complicated to get out of the deal, so the mayor is going along with it.
I believe the problem for the city is it was a very well-negotiated contract that put a lot of penalties in place if the city tried to get out of this contract. Getting out of the contract just was not a financially viable option for the city. And this is a city that does not have a lot of financial resources to pay for water from one source that it's not going to use.
Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody. Always great to talk with you, Steve. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
The U.S. men's soccer team has a huge showdown tonight with the world's number one ranked team, Argentina. These unbeaten teams will square off tonight in Houston in the semifinals of the Copa America Centenario. Now, there was a time when that news might have been greeted with a shrug in this country, but no longer. The popularity of soccer in the U.S. has exploded, and University of Michigan professor Andre Markovitz thinks much of that soccer excitement has been fueled by a video game, EA Sports FIFA. And Andre, what does this game let players do?
It's actually incredible. I don't play it because I'm an old man, but my co-author, of course, plays it. And he was a Michigan undergraduate, just graduated, and is off to the world.
Shout out to Adam Green.
Shout out to Adam Green. Wonderful, wonderful kid. Will be very, very successful in life. And basically, it started with my mentioning at the end of my lecture, in one of the lectures in my huge sports class, as to what the effects of video game are in terms of creating culture, in terms of creating reality, okay? And I said, I'd love to have someone join me doing this research, because I can't do the research because I don't play video games and I do not understand this culture. And that's how it started with Adam. And we worked on this very hard, and it became a published article in a very renowned scholarly journal called Sports and Society. And so basically what we're arguing here is that the video game has created a major cultural reality that reinforces the growing discourse and awareness about soccer in the United States. Mm-hmm. It doesn't cause it, or we will never be able to actually have a chicken and an egg thing, clearly.
Sure.
But it's very clearly a reinforcing mechanism, meaning that when you play this game, which is, by the way, in its most recent reincarnation, FIFA 15, I think, or maybe already 16, it's really incredible. I mean, I, of course, follow soccer like many other sports constantly, and it's like it's a live event.
So if I want to play as Manchester United's Wayne Rooney, I'm going to look like Wayne Rooney.
You see Wayne Rooney. And when you play Real Madrid, and there, of course, is Ronaldo, you mm-hmm. see him preening and being this sort of cocky guy who, when he lines up for a 20-yard free kick, is basically really like a peacock, sort of wanting mm-hmm. to sort of showing, look at me, I am the greatest. Unbelievable. It's absolutely incredible.
And your study argues that this really has lit the fire of soccer fandom. Is that translating into people actually playing and also into people going to MLS matches?
Yes, but it's sort of a very complicated thing because I wish I could have more money and more time to do the further research. But for example, this Saturday, I went to a bar mitzvah celebration, bar and bat mitzvah, I should say, boy and girl, twins. And at my table was a University of Michigan law professor with his, I think, 11-year-old boy, who is a huge FIFA fan. And he, however, loves the video game but doesn't follow the sport. So that also exists. So what you do have is, in fact, people who to whom the video game is just a great thing, and they play it because it's interactive. Mm-hmm. You play it with anybody in the world. You can play it at any time. So what I'm saying here is that there are multiple levels of reality here. Clearly, there is this young kid, typically almost always a boy because video games are heavily male, who starts playing Barcelona and falls in love with EA the sports, I mean, the FIFA the game, and then translates that to the real Barcelona. And that is, in fact, then a venue into the world of soccer.
There you go. And that's the portal. And now it's available to watch, in your living room because they got wise and networks have picked it up. I know NBC, when they started carrying English Premier League soccer, football, I should say, that was a game changer in our lives.
Absolutely. Yeah. Basically, there are these multiple levels which have really introduced and proliferated the game to a degree that is absolutely unbelievable. And you're quite right that tonight's match against Argentina is a major thing. I mean, people will follow this and have followed it and discuss it.
All right. I have to ask you, do you want to make a pick for tonight, U.S. versus Argentina?
Well, my heart, of course, I'm already bleeding. Of course, red, white, and blue. I'm always have, but I fear you cannot beat Messi. So I would give the U.S. no better chance of prevailing than 15%.
Andre Markovitz, University of Michigan professor. Among other books, he's author of Gaming the World, How Sports Are Reshaping Global Politics and Culture, and Sportista, Female Fandom in the United States. Always great to talk with you, Andre. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Michigan has a rich history of wonderful writers. Well, there are certainly the marquee names, but how about those writers who've somehow been put on the shelf and who are there waiting to be rediscovered? Jack Dempsey and his brother Dave are doing their level best to get us all paying attention to these unheralded Michigan writers. They're out with their latest book, Ink Trails 2, Michigan's Famous and Forgotten Authors. Jack Dempsey, so good to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
You bring us 16 writers' stories in this second version of Ink Trails. What criteria do you use in deciding who makes the cut?
Well, it's a couple. One is they have to be no longer with us. I tend to joke about being a lawyer from time to time, and of course, we don't want to get sued by anybody for what we're saying, although generally we're pretty complimentary about the folks who are in the book. But more importantly, the writing has to be about Michigan or to be sourced, based, influenced, inspired by Michigan. So someone who lived here maybe for a short period of time or who was born and raised and lived here their entire life.
Let's start by talking – we're going to start in lovely Plymouth, actually, and talk about Russell Kirk, who really had ties to two Michigan areas.
Two, if not three, actually, Plymouth and then East Lansing and then up in Mecosta County. I found his story particularly fascinating. I live in Plymouth Township, and Russell Kirk grew up in the city of Plymouth. We're very connected together as a community, but went to school in Plymouth and loved to learn and read literature.
And when was he in school in Plymouth?
In the mid 20th century,
yeah.
Roughly.
Okay.
Then went to school at Michigan State, ended up doing some teaching there, but ended up as really for the most part of his life in Mecosta County on his family's sort of ancestral home. And out of the Plymouth, East Lansing, Mecosta experience, all kinds of fascinating contributions to political thought, cultural thought, literature.
And someone who even went back to the ancestral homeland of Scotland to live and study.
Yeah, he went over to Scotland to study and became, I think, really transformed by that experience, came back to the U.S., to Michigan, and brought that sense of tradition, sense of centuries of experience. You know, we're a young country, but over in Scotland, they've been there for hundreds of years. And ended up, as I say, in Mecosta County, where he wrote both thought about conservatism and then Gothic novels.
Which is a fascinating mix. Fascinating.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so a very eclectic writer in a sense as a strong conservative voice, but there you say, Gothic novels. Then there's Della Thompson Lutz, who has the label Gallant Figure. Why is that?
That was the assessment given to her by one of her friends, associates. And that, I think, is a really good insight, a summary of what she was about. Most people who have read anything about her have read about this you know, the country cookbook type of writing that she did. So that sounds very positive, like we're watching one of these modern cooking shows, which are full of fun and effervescence. Yeah, absolutely. But her life was full of difficulty, losing a son, a divorce, which was not really disclosed or talked about in that era. And so the way that she coped with the difficulties, the tragedies, the struggles in life, and yet produce literature that is still in print, that is about the experience of growing up in rural Michigan on the farm in a farmhouse with that good farm-to-table cooking, really still resonates with us. But we also need to know why she was able to do this in the face of tragedy.
I've kind of got the sense as I was reading you, your description of her life, is that it gave her a good place to be, a refuge.
I think that's a very good way of saying it, that going back and thinking about what it was like to grow up in that era and to try to speak to the women of the nation about how important their role is, even if they aren't given the same opportunity, they have major contributions to make. They're the ones that bear, in many cases, in that era, in any era, you know, the real heavy burden of making life work for their family. And so I think she is a gallant figure that we need to understand the whole story of.
And her life straddled the 19th into the 20th centuries. Where did she grow up?
She grew up in rural Jackson County, where people, I think, would say, well, what comes out of Jackson County? Nothing. But obviously, it's a very fertile ground for people to experience life and then to write about it.
I'm talking with Jack Dempsey about his book, Ink Trails 2, Michigan's Famous and Forgotten Authors. And then we'll round third base and talk about the Civil War hero from Michigan who has a town in Arizona named after him, but we kind of don't even have even a little statue for Orlando Bolivar Wilcox. Who was he?
He was one of the early citizens of Detroit, going back before Michigan was a state, so a kind of pioneer in Detroit, went to West Point, served gallantly as a soldier for the United States, was a hero, I would submit, among the greatest heroes of the Civil War, and is buried in Arlington National Cemetery, which is an appropriate recognition for his service, for his life, for his devotion to our nation. For some reason, his story, though, has basically been forgotten in Michigan.
What was stunning was there he was, and it was the military action he led that caused Lee to say, we're done, we're surrendering. And again, he is forgotten. But then where does the writing fit in? Was that while he was in the military, or did he finally decide it was time to be a civilian and pick up a pen?
He began writing before the Civil War as a civilian, after his West Point experience and after Mexican War service, and wrote about what it was like to grow up in Detroit when it was a very small town. People knew each other. You had a lot of French influence still. Interesting aspect to that. One of the persons that he wrote about tried to do it in a fiction standpoint, from a fiction standpoint, ended up blocking his advancement as an officer. And so perhaps part of the story in his case is that his writing backfired on his career in the military.
Got him in trouble with the brass. Can we find these people's books and writings fairly easily, Jack?
In general, I would say yes, thanks to the internet. Many books are available online, especially if the copyright has expired. In many other cases, though, their books are still in print. They're still published. And so in many cases, you can go to a bookstore or you can order them online and get the actual copy, current copy, reprinted copy of their work. But online, you will find many of these books still available that you can read on your laptop or your device.
Well, this is just a sampling, three of the 16 very, very interesting stories that Jack Dempsey and his brother Dave Dempsey bring to us in their book, Ink Trails 2, Michigan's Famous and Forgotten Authors. We know the famous ones. It's sure good to discover the forgotten ones. Thank you so much, Jack.
Thank you for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Some breaking news for you. Michigan Radio's Rick Pluta reports that Governor Snyder has signed that controversial package of legislation to restructure Detroit's public schools. Among other things, the $617 million package splits the district into two entities, one that takes on the old district's debt and the other to run the schools and educate students. And it would return the district to a locally elected school board next year. The package passed the legislature earlier this month on largely party lines. Over to school boards around Michigan, where the Help Wanted sign is out because there's a shortage of candidates for school boards. Some 1,600 seats in 540 districts are up for grabs in the November election, with a filing deadline of July 26. Now, last time around, in 2014, about 70 seats in local school boards went begging. They had no takers. Here with us now are the holders of two school board seats that will need to be filled this November. Both are longtime school board members, and both are not running for re-election. Carol Klainau has served on the Utica Community School Board for 23 years, 21 of them as board president. Carol, welcome.
Well, thank you, Cynthia. It's great to be here.
Howard Wallach has been on the Farmington Public Schools Board since 2004. He is currently the president of the school board. So good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for taking the time to really share your experiences. And I want to start with you, Carol. Why have you decided not to run for re-election?
Well, honestly, 23 years is a lot of community service, and I think I've done my fair share, and it's time to pass the baton.
How about you?
It's not that I'm not running. My term actually ends in December of 2018. So I have resigned my seat, and therefore it has to be filled by the board, and then that candidate has to run in November because of the timing of things.
Why did you resign?
Similar kind of reason, actually. I have been involved in various organizations. I'm Jewish, and I was involved in four different Jewish communal organizations for many years and took leadership roles in them and then became a school board member. So I've got about 30, 32 years of public service in one fashion or another, and just felt like it was time.
You both really have that kind of sense of it's time to lay down my arms and let someone else pick up that shield. I want to start with you, Howard, in a 12 years perspective you have on your school board. How have things changed?
I think the focus on finances has been dramatic. Obviously, it's important. We always looked at it. We spent time on it. You have to balance your budget by June 30 in Michigan under Michigan law, even though the legislature sometimes doesn't pass their budget until October or November or later, which is the craziest system you can imagine because that's where we get our money from. But the focus on finance has increased dramatically over the past 12 years. We used to have resources that we could try some experimental programs, do some innovative kinds of things. That kind of money's gone. You don't have the ability to do those kinds of things anymore. Much more time every year is spent on it because the state has the ability, even though they might tell you in May, in anticipation of you passing your June budget, that we're going to increase your allocation by $100, $150, $75 a student, they can take it back in the middle of the school year.
So you could wind up starting in the hole as the year starts?
Not could happen. It has happened to us.
That is tough. What have you seen? You certainly have the perspective of your 23 years, Carol.
Howard very accurately describes what's happened. Proposal A was going to herald a whole new world of school funding in Michigan. And Proposal A, as we all know, looking back, is a funding mechanism that really works well in good times. Nobody could have anticipated the economy as things played out in the last decade in Michigan. But Proposal A just isn't working for today's economy and today's system. What I have seen is in the 90s, things were going very well. The economy is doing well. So there was good funding. But in addition, in Utica, there was rapid growth. There were years where we would grow by 500 to 700 children, which is a huge growth.
Yes.
And because the district was so large, we could take in that many kids. It was several years before we had to actually build buildings. So it was really very efficient for us, and things were good. In the last 10 years, of course, things have not been that good, again, for the reasons Howard cited. And now we are faced with not only the funding from the state not being adequate, but also we're now facing enrollment decline, as everybody else is. The birth rate went down in Macomb County for certain. I think statewide it plays out. So you're actually graduating several hundred more children than you are bringing in kindergarten. So for Utica, we're looking at about 400 children less as our students in the fall. And that has a significant impact on funding. When I read our Lansing update, at one point the governor was proposing that they would do a 50-50 split on student count to help with the declining districts. And my understanding now is they're going back to 90-10, which means for a district like Utica, 90% of the funding will be based on the fall count, which will make it very hard for us or other declining enrollment districts. That's probably $1 million swing in the budget we have to adopt June 30th. Even though we don't really know what our funding is going to be. So
as you describe this, I get this image of people climbing up a wall, and that wall is loaded with grease, and you kind of see slide that you can't get there. As you say, as you start the year and you're already in the hole.
Well, yeah, Proposal A has been particularly bad for larger districts, mm-hmm. because when you think about it, the larger districts used to fund their districts primarily through property taxes, and their voters voted on spending money how they wanted to on schools or not. So now all of our money is going to the state, and the rural districts who have smaller populations, it's been a windfall for them. Even in bad times, they're doing much better than the bigger districts are because they're getting the same amount of allocation, yet not contributing the same amount of money to the pool. Since 2003, the cost of living increase has been about 48%. In that same time period, our school district allocation has gone up a tiny bit and then in the last several years dropped and leveled off. So it's about 16%. Before we open our doors, we're 30% behind the eight ball. And then add all of the other problems that Lansing has in terms of trying to figure out how to run the pension fund and the changes that have happened in that. When we started with Proposal A, we were contributing 5% of every dollar that we got from the state to the pension fund. Now it's up over 27, 28%. It's just not
sustainable
at all.
The other thing I'm interested in is your perspective on what you've seen over your years on the school board in terms of legislative involvement in school affairs. Carol?
I would describe it as legislative overreach in school affairs. People will talk about local control. I think Howard can certainly speak his own mind, but I think the only thing that's left for local control is what to cut. I mean, there are very few things now that a local school board can decide because most everything is legislated to the point that there's now legislation on how you evaluate your teachers, your administrators. We've gone to that level of prescription in terms of how you run your school district.
Why do you think this is? I'll make that a jump ball question. Why is this overreach the way it is?
Well, I think part of it is that there's an agenda by the leadership in Lansing about what they want to do with public education, and part of that is to get more of it into privatized schools. I think that's just absolutely clear. But what you're seeing is the attempt to implement a business model on a school system. Round peg in a square hole is the first analogy that comes to mind. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't work. It's good in business to have all kinds of metrics and analysis and things like that, but you've got people who are not educators legislating how to run a business that they don't know anything about.
Caroline, as you look at your years, your 23 years on a school board, you're feeling problems that predate Rick Snyder's time as governor.
Again, Proposal A is primarily the driver of some of this, and I just think it took 20 years to have it kind of come to fruition in terms of what happens in a down economy. Mm-hmm. Under the Snyder administration, things have accelerated, but going back to why is all of this happening, I think it goes back further because when the Obama administration was doing Race to the Top, which was competitive funding, the state wanted to compete for those funds, and in order to be competitive for those funds, there are certain things you had to have in place. Our legislature very quickly passed the legislation to meet the criteria to apply for Race to the Top money. We never got the money, but the legislation never went away. So the teacher evaluation, some of the other things. And then the state testing, of course, the parents are starting to really push back on that issue. There's just a lot of different things that have been driven by people outside of schools. The you must start school after Labor Day. Our parents aren't really happy about that. They'd prefer to maybe have the flexibility to start in August. I mean, so those little things, when you start adding them up, there's just very little that's left for local decision making. Our community hasn't quite figured all that out. As Howard mentioned, people are taxed locally. The money goes to Lansing for the school aid fund, and then it's redistributed through the legislature. And I am quite shocked and also concerned that our local citizens will, in anger when you're cutting something that they're not happy about, will say, but I pay taxes to Utica schools. And the answer is, well, you pay taxes to schools.
Right.
And the legislature decides where your money gets redistributed.
Dating right back to March 94 with Proposal
A. Yeah. Yes. And so they don't understand it, and they'll equate, oh, all these new homes are being built, so the school should be fine. No. So there's a lot of education in our part, and I think people just in their busy lives, especially if you have children in school, you're busy parents, I don't think they take the time to really learn about it until it affects them. And right now there's a lot of people being affected by school board decisions.
We're talking about the reality of serving on school boards as we talk with Carol Klina of the Utica Community School Board. She served for 23 years. Howard Wallach is with us with the Farmington Public Schools Board since 2004. Both not going to be continuing. Howard has resigned his seat. Carol, you are not going to run for re-election. And we know tough decisions have got to be made by school boards, whether it's closing a school or cut an effective program. Howard, what's the most difficult decision you've had to make?
Our board has gone through this now twice. The first time that we talked about privatization was about 3 or 4 years ago. We decided not to at that time. Our bargaining units were able to make concessions that made things work. And when you do that, you affect people whose jobs you are taking. You affect the community because in our district, many of our employees live in our district at all levels, whether they're bus drivers, custodians, teachers, administrators. And they rightfully say, you know, my little Johnny knows the bus driver, and I know that that bus driver's going to be safe, driving safely with my child. And you're going to bring in people from the outside and all of those kinds of arguments. I think that's probably the toughest decision we have to make because you have to look squarely at people who you know and you like and you've seen and maybe have driven your kids or you work with if they're a custodian or a lunch person. So taking a person's job away is a very, very difficult one. Let me tag on to what Carol said a minute ago because you were asking about, you know, it's not all on Snyder's watch, and I couldn't agree more. There's bipartisanship in terms of the problem that has gone on here. I'm going to take you back to 1994 when Governor Engler supported the change in public funding of schools with Proposal A. But there was a special exemption, and it was a line item called 20J in the budget. And 20J was a allocation that said, essentially, if your school district is already spending more money because your voters approved it than what the state's going to allocate, we're not going to take that money away from you. So we got about $2,000 per student for many years that other districts didn't have because we were already supporting our kids at a higher level. And in the swoop of a pen, Governor Granholm took that away from us 1 year because the school aid fund and the budget in general was in such bad shape. And that happened in October after we've already written our budget and approved it as required by law in June. It can be disastrous, and that year was.
What's your toughest decision in a nutshell, Carol?
I think any decision that has to do with people losing their jobs, I would rank the worst, and I would agree with Howard. However, there's another side of the school board that is not as well observed, and that is when you have to render judgment in an appeal of an expulsion. I really find those difficult because in that setting, you have a family with their child who did something probably a poor decision. Often it's a good kid who just made a poor decision that one day, and the consequences are dire. And when you're sitting there listening to the family kind of explain the rationale for why we shouldn't uphold the recommendation to expel their child, it is just very, very difficult. Most times the facts are clear and you still have to uphold that expulsion decision or recommendation. Your heart goes out to them, and you do know that kids can just get a wild idea and do something, not thinking long term. And those, to me, are also very, very difficult decisions for a board.
Are either of you surprised there's a shortage of people willing to run for school boards in Michigan?
Absolutely not.
Not at all. I think it might fit the definition of thankless job. I don't know. I'm sure there's other jobs out there, but there's less and less influence on what you can do in the school district. You're not really shaping the district's direction to the extent you could have back when I first started on the school board. It's just much more difficult and hard to find that intrinsic satisfaction because you're just making decisions that are painful.
I think there's another component, too, to that. The notion that what we see play out on the news every night about people in Lansing and people in Washington who are politicians and their behavior, some of which is very bad, trickles down into the local community where now although we can't raise a millage for operations, we might have to have a millage for a bond or buildings or technology or those kinds of things. And they're going to come to your school board and they're going to start screaming at you. And what do you see on TV at 11 o'clock is that little soundbite where somebody's screaming at a school board. And people are sitting back and saying, why would I take that job? Why would I stick my neck out and have to take that abuse when all they're trying to do is the best they can under the circumstances that exist at the time? I fully understand people aren't going to like every decision I make. And you know that going into taking this position. But it's a far cry from I disagree with you to abusiveness. And I think people see that that happens and they say there's no reason for me to take time away from my family or from my work or anything else that I'm doing.
Bottom line, as we wrap up, what will it mean if not enough people are willing to step up and take those empty seats on school boards?
I think one of the things that you'll see is single agenda individuals who can rally the troops, so to speak, on that agenda and don't really have the agenda of public education first in their mind being elected. Maybe only once, but now they'll have several years to kind of wreak havoc on what's going on and perhaps try to undo things that other school boards voted upon. It could be anything from you decide to close a building or to reorganize or to do other kinds of things, eliminate programs if you, God forbid, have to. And they say, no, we're bringing that back. And they don't understand that when you push the balloon on this side, there's a reaction on the other end, or they don't care.
I agree. I also think there's kind of a trickle down that will begin to happen. You cannot run an organization when the governing body is dysfunctional. So over time, it does catch up with the reputation, community perception, and a school district that has a dysfunctional board, I believe, will begin to lose students because the community will lose confidence. However, I think another trickle down or perhaps unforeseen consequences, then it begins to affect the quality of the leadership of the school district that you hire. For example, if you have boards with single issue, I absolutely agree, single issue people that really don't care about the overall strategic direction, the long-term health of the district, they're just there for their issue, it's going to be harder and harder to find quality superintendents or first-line executive leadership in school districts. We already see some of that today. It's very hard to find superintendents who are talented and qualified. The pool, I mean, you can find them, but it's just not the same number of applicants that you would have found, say, 15 or 20 years ago. So the difficulty with boards, I think, does affect the long-term leadership in the school districts, too. So, and that concerns me.
Absolutely.
We need good brains. We need good talent in schools.
Carol Kleino has been on the Utica Community School Board for 23 years, 21 of those as board president. Howard Wallach has served on the Farmington Public Schools Board since 2004. Thanks to both of you for giving us a sense of what it's like to be on a school board in Michigan. It was great to meet you. Thank you.
I have to congratulate Carol. 21 years as president is just amazing. I think I'm in my third or fourth term as president, and I thought that was a lot. You're amazing.
You know, I still love the work, though. I really do. It's been very rewarding, and despite all the things we said that makes it difficult, I still highly recommend people think about it because most of the time it's more rewarding than it is challenging.
Agreed.
Thanks to both of
you. And you meet some great people.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Mike Blank. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.